This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The reason for a mysterious mass extinction event may have been found. The crisis hundreds of millions of years ago was not caused by something from outer space or volcanoes. It was a combination of two threats we have today, global warming and the ozone hole. So that sounds like news we need to know. The title of the paper just published in Science Advances is UVB Radiation Was the Devonian Carboniferous Boundary Terrestrial Extinction Kill Mechanism. The lead author is Professor John Marshall from the University of Southampton in the UK. From Southampton, Dr. Marshall, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Your paper reveals a lot, and based on fossil records in eastern Greenland, except when those rocks were laid down, Greenland was not the frozen northern continent we know today, was it?
No, it would be like in the Sahara Desert, or perhaps like Death Valley in California. It was in the interior of a continent and extremely dry.
And the continents have moved around a lot, so Greenland wasn't even where Greenland is.
Yes, it's about 30 degrees south, so it has moved a lot, yes.
It seems a long way from tiny spores and black rock to a global kill mechanism, so let's start building that chain. What are spores, John, and what did these ancient spores tell you about their environment on Earth at that time?
Well, they're like pollen, really, and everybody knows what pollen are. And we give them a different name because they're from plants which don't have seeds. Things like ferns have spores rather than pollen.
You studied two lakes in the rock records from hundreds of millions of years ago, but why did the interior of that ancient continent, known to be chronically dry, as you say, turn so wet that vast new lakes were formed?
We can see that it's driven by a monsoon-type climate circulation, in that, like the monsoon today, if you put a lot more heat into the earth, it gets hotter and hotter in the arid continental interiors, and that eventually forces a circulation of damp water, effectively, which then rises and gives you these rains. So you go from a very arid climate to a deep, permanent, stratified lake, many tens and tens of meters deep, probably hundreds of meters deep, that was probably about the size of Belgium.
I know when I visited Arizona, I was surprised that they get monsoons in the summer, even though they're a desert region, and maybe what you've just described could happen to Australia's interior in the future.
Oh, it does. It does now, in that Lake Eyre in the interior of Australia gets significant rainfall and floods out about every 7 years or so. But then it dries out in the interim. What we had in Greenland was monsoons, which must have been about every year, because it made this very deep lake in an arid interior, which never dried out.
As I understand it, scientists have identified two periods of extinction as the Devonian period closed around, say, 350 million years ago. And the first was caused by a change in glaciation and a big drop in sea level, but the second was brought about by warming and ozone depletion, which is the focus of your paper. Can you quickly orient us to the two mass extinctions that occurred in that period of time?
Yes, it's not quite true. There's one slightly earlier, which we call, confusingly, the Late Devonian or the Franian-Fermenian mass extinction, sometimes known as the Kelvasser. And that was because of a large igneous province when you got a continental-scale passive volcanic eruptions destabilized the Earth system. What we've got at the Devonian Carboniferous boundary are two mass extinctions separated by about 300,000 years. And the lower one looks to be the onset of the glaciation and cooling, and the upper one is the one I've described in this new paper.
And that's the Hagenberg event?
And that's the Hagenberg. But they have these German names because they were first recognized in Germany.
John Marshall, how severe was the last glacial episode of the Devonian period, which would be the starting point for the great warming indicated by your observations?
Well, you had a glaciation for probably a few million years, maybe three, like today, But inside that, you have interglacial cycles when the ice effectively comes away from the pole and moves to lower latitudes. And it was the last of these glacial cycles which got to about maybe 35 degrees paleo-south. So it got far closer to the equator than the last ice age ever did.
Is it fair to say when examining this mass extinction event from 359 million years ago or so, your team was following earlier research by Dutch scientist Henk Visscher's group, who also found UVB damage in fossil spores on Greenland?
No. They were at a quite younger time in the Permo-Triassic, and we had no idea that we would ever find this. And I was really going back to look at the Devonian Carboniferous boundary to see if I could see something of the character of how the different plant groups became extinct. Was it all together? Was it stepwise? Which went first? And that might inform me something about mass extinction. So then we found these malformed spores, which were like Henk Visscher and colleagues found, and that was a surprise to us.
And after Visscher's Greenland discoveries, mutated spores from the end Permian mass extinction event were found in many other parts of the world, confirming the results. Have your Greenland results from the earlier extinction we're talking about here also appeared in other places?
Oh, yes. I mean, malformed spores now are not commonly known, but they occur at the Triassic, Jurassic mass extinction and the Permo-Triassic. And I've even found one small level with them in the Franian, Fermenian, late Devonian mass extinction.
Did I read correctly in your paper that the death of forests and other plant life led to a wave of nutrients from decaying plants being washed into the sea, and that somehow led to the release of ozone-destroying chemicals into the atmosphere?
Yes, there's a positive feedback on the system, in that what happens is you collapse a forest, and we know this because we've counted lots of tree fossils, stumps effectively going up to the boundary, and then they just completely disappear. So we've quantitatively counted them. And if you suddenly remove a forest and you move also the understory layer in the forest, that's the smaller fern-like plants which grow between the biggest trees, you then suddenly have an ecosystem which has got probably a highish rainfall, and everything is then going to get eroded off. It's the same as if you have a tropical rainforest and you clear it, all the nutrients end up in the nearest river and they're lost to us. And so if you're doing this on a continental scale, you're going to release nutrients into the sea, and then productivity of algae and other things in the sea will go up and up. And then there's a byproduct of a biochemical pathway, a metabolic pathway, in many fungi, plants, algae, which produces ozone-eating chemicals.
I'm hoping you can clear up my naive confusion on reading your paper. It sounds like the forest died, a lot of nutrients were washed into the sea, chlorine was released by marine organisms or something, and that damaged the ozone layer, leading to a mutation, including tree spores, which damaged the forest. But that's sort of a circle.
Yes. We think as you came out of the ice age, it got quite warm, and it's probably to do with rates at which things are happening, and it's happening quite fast. So all the time up there, the ozone is being destroyed and it's being replaced. So there's a constant flux of ozone up in the stratosphere. And so once you start to thin it and you start to kill some of the trees, you then push things faster and you positively feed it, feedback loop. So you have to start killing some things first. So when you look at the nature of how these fossil spores become extinct, there's one or two groups just disappear. They just go. And it's only in the survivors that we see the malformation.
And as you know, a series of scientists, beginning with the German paleontologist Otto Schwindwolf, suggested mutagenic extinctions and ozone depletion had astrophysical causes, whether it was energy coming from a supernova explosion or changes to solar winds and magnetic fields. Can we rule all that out in the case that you studied?
I've certainly had a number of emails since we've published this paper pointing this out, and it's always been known, but it's always been impossible to prove it. Now, we may have a way of proving it by looking for a magnetic reversal in the bed, which is supposed to be what would happen. The other thing is that it's the amount of malformation we see in these spores or pollen grains becomes greater as you go into the middle of the lake bed. We know it's a symmetrical climate cycle. It warms and then it cools. And so we get a direct correlation, not necessarily a cause, between the amount of heat in the system and the amount of malformation.
Interesting. So what was the composition of the atmosphere at that time, especially regarding carbon and oxygen? I know that that atmospheric composition was a factor in the later great extinction event around 250 million years ago. What about in this case?
We think that oxygen was fairly similar. It wouldn't have been identical today, but it stays within certain limits. And we've certainly measured the charcoal content through the extinction level, and oxygen is not dropping, because that would be a way of reducing the ozone layer by reducing the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. You'd basically slow it down, the rates of reaction. We also know it's not higher, because at a certain level you get spontaneous wildfires, so it stays within certain limits. Carbon dioxide may be lower, and it's possible that as you've gone through Devonian time, you've got the first forests, and these have taken in organic matter and buried it. At the same time, you've got a very extensive coral reefs, because what these first forests are doing are releasing nutrients into the sea, and that's causing plankton to bloom. It's also releasing calcium and magnesium, so that's what reefs are built of, with their calcium carbonate, their limestone skeletons. So it's all sort of pointing in that direction, that you're burying CO2. So it may well be that these ice ages are more likely because you've got a lower CO2 world. It's possible that it's not changing the temperature that much, but it makes the climate more unstable. It's more likely to tip in certain directions. There's less resilience in the system.
Yes, that was something that shocked me when I read that in your, I think it was in the abstract of your paper. And I'm wondering, are we in a similar situation right now where we have less resilience and more open to extreme changes?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting, and the modelers have got to get at this yet, because they tend to model certain sorts of worlds, and they've not really had this perception of a Devonian world in this way. And what it suggests is, because we don't have a large igneous province doing it, and we've proved it's not because there's no mercury signal in the rocks from volcanoes, so if it's heating, and it's a rate of heating, it could well be a side effect of a current global warming we're seeing today. In the same process, which acted in the Devonian, it's not the Devonian world we live in, but the processes will be the same, could basically start to strip the ozone out. And this has been modeled and, to a certain extent, observed in the mid-continent of the United States by ozone scientists. They saw there was a great flux of water vapor high up into the stratosphere in very hot summers, and the same process could happen.
And what does that water vapor in the upper atmosphere have to do with the ozone layer?
It carries with it these ozone-eating natural chemicals, so it's sort of methyl chloride or chloromethane, so it's a chlorine or sometimes a bromine atom with a little bit of carbon and hydrogen on it. And they get carried up into the stratosphere where they get warmed up, and then they start to naturally break apart, and they release basically a chlorine and oxygen combined little free radical, which then zips around and catalytically destroys the ozone.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from the University of Southampton, Dr. John Marshall. Groundbreaking new science about a mass extinction event 359 million years ago points to deadly risks possible in our future. John, it has taken at least 30 years to unwind the public misconception that the ozone hole is causing global warming. Probably millions of people still believe that. But now your research stands this on its head, saying global warming can cause destruction of the ozone layer. Please walk us how you think this can happen.
Well, it's the process where if you get more transport of naturally occurring ozone-eating chemicals high up into the atmosphere, into this layer called the stratosphere, they're able to catalytically break down ozone. And it's a process, and it's probably the rate at which it happens. So if we put more heat in our atmosphere, we're likely to start to get holes maybe forming over some of the continental areas. It was probably very patchy as a process. Of course, plants can survive. You may have a garden, and you may know that certain things are impossible to get out, like horsetail ferns. Once they start growing, they can grow from the tiniest fragment. So it's very sort of difficult to make them extinct, whereas animals are quite easy to make extinct. You can do that in a year if you destroy the habitat.
So a major warming, ozone became so depleted that many species went extinct from the effects of UVB radiation. In a 2018 paper, Jeffrey Benka called that a pulsed ozone shield weakening. How long do you think that break in our protective ozone shield may have lasted?
We know this because we can see it's within one lake cycle, and these lake cycles are controlled by orbital wobbles in the Earth. So the orbit of the Earth around the Sun changes with precession, obliquity, and eccentricity. And those are on about 20,000, about 40,000, and 100 or 400,000 years. So the thing is like a sort of wobbling orange as it goes round. Sometimes the orbit is circular, sometimes it's more like an ellipse. And we know from how much time we've got in the section and various mathematical things we can do that the lakes probably lasted about 18 to 20,000 years, and the deep part of a lake probably lasted about 10 or 11,000 years. So that's the level of time the extinction took.
Not very long.
No. So geologically, you could blink and miss it. And so that's one of the advantages of working in Greenland, because we're in a continental basin which has got a lot of sediment piling into it. So we, like a tape recorder spooling fast, we get a very good record.
And I presume the high warming reached at the end of the Devonian Age was related to the high levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it may have warmed slowly, perhaps over thousands or even millions of years. Now we're raising Earth's temperature in less than 200 years. Do you have any idea of the speed that a global ozone depletion crisis could be approaching us if your research is correct?
We don't know, and it's actually quite scary, because if you look at these past warming events, this one, the one which you get at the start of a Cenozoic period, they take thousands of years to build up, whereas we've got the same rates of warming over hundreds of years. And it maybe will be like living in Australia, where most Caucasian Australians get skin cancer. And they all protect themselves very clearly and very obviously when they go outside.
There was a really alarming warning in the abstract of your paper that really caused me to phone you up, and it's this. Ozone loss during rapid warming is an inherent Earth system process, with the unavoidable conclusion that we should be alert for such an eventuality in the future warming world. Would you like to expand on that?
Yes. If you have an asteroid, it's something which comes from outer space. And that's, to a certain extent, we can now predict it because we can plot them out. And we can map them in orbit of the Earth, and we know what's happening. A large igneous province, we would know when it went off, and it would take quite a time to build up. But what we've spotted is there's another mechanism in the Earth which can cause a mass extinction. So this is effectively a warming from deep time. So by understanding how other groups have gone extinct, we can then predict effectively our futures. And so this is something we should be alert for and should start modeling oceans, atmospheres, modelling ozone, and so on. So we're now hoping to do a series of experiments with plants like ferns, which have spores with spines, like we were finding in Madevonian, which is still alive today. And we would do various experiments with ultraviolet light and effectively try and get the same mutations. And then we could start to work out flux, the amount maybe of ultraviolet light you need to cause this sort of damage. Because pollen and spores are very predictive little objects, and they're designed to protect the plant cells, the reproductive bits, from damaging UV radiation. So they grow this little waterproof and UV-proof coat around them. And if that's delayed or the UVB gets in any way, it then mutates the DNA and the things become sterile. So it's something we really need to know about. For anything like crop protection, food security, if all of a sudden your pollination's not going to work properly, it's quite important that we know that and can predict it.
It would be handy to know whether we have decades or hundreds of years to save the ozone from global warming.
Yes, and that's something for the modelers. I mean, I'm not a modeler. I'm a geologist and a paleontologist, and we do quite different things. But they tend to model the sorts of worlds they know about. And what we've been able to show them from deep time is that other worlds exist, which we need to consider.
This paper in Science Advances offers a novel explanation for the last great mystery about great extinction events. Have other scientists reacted? Has there been pushback or acceptance so far?
It's quite interesting. Some people just really buy into it immediately, and they can see many of the strange things which happened at this DC boundary. There's instability in some sea creatures. In other words, the fossils we see don't evolve very well, and they're suddenly very diverse. They're not stable in how they're reproducing. So if you got effectively a collection of sea worms living in the upper water column, and you had UVB on them, they would be mutating, and they would have this instability in lineages. The people who look at early tetrapods, that's animals with feet and hands, effectively, which had just come onto land, again, they really kickstart their evolution and go in a different direction. And we've always known that frogs and UV light don't go well together, and you get mutations. And, of course, many mutations or most mutations are not helpful, but some may well push them and give them advantageous flaws which move evolution forward. The modelers have, some are sort of, there was one in Science Advances, and I could see that he was effectively writing the grant in his head. In other words, he said it was something to further study and would need a lot of modeling to be able to understand it better.
We can always say that, but we're kind of under pressure here because we're in a mass extinction event, we're told, and that's partly due to destruction of habitat and partly due to climate change and other factors. But we don't have a lot of time to sort out the very questions that you raised.
We've probably got decades, and that's probably enough time. And I think once you know this thing is happening, you can start to prepare for it in certain ways. You can look at crop resistance, and you can predict what might happen, which is a good thing. Other things, of course, are unpredictable, and a lot of it's the rates at which things happen. In other words, we could have predicted we would have a pandemic, but not this year. But we would know it would happen every few decades or so on, and certainly as animal husbandry changed and populations grew. So this sort of prediction is something just to be alert for. You may remember that everybody got very worried about asteroids once the recognition there was a large asteroid impact at the Cretaceous-Paleogene boundary and the death of the dinosaurs. And it was probably about 10 or 20 years of active work starting to plot these in the near-Earth orbit. And so now there's probably about 10 or 20 people around the world monitoring them, and if they start to see something becomes chaotic, you can then do something about it.
And we'll have to watch the forest, the ozone, and the climate and those relationships in a similar way, perhaps.
Yes, and we'll have to sort of monitor it more and sort of probably send more experiments aloft and so on. They certainly monitor the ozone, but of course the attention's very much at the pole. And so now it may be that we can focus some of that attention at looking at the large continental areas in the summer times to see what happens. And so because, of course, it's polar holes, that's where the equipment is focused.
And that's even though I'm told most of the ozone is produced around the tropics and then sort of, let's say, gets circulated to the poles and collects there.
Yes, that's right. And it goes up there and sort of, you know, they get natural thinning. But it is quite intense. I mean, I've worked in the southern hemisphere, and you certainly notice it even in a cloudy day in what they would call the summer. You certainly get burnt very fast.
Interesting, and that could be our future. From the University of Southampton, we've been speaking with Professor John Marshall about studying new science, I think, on a great extinction and the risk of UV radiation as our Earth warms. John, thank you for spending time with us.
Well, thank you indeed, and thank you for your interest and those of your listeners.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
While we struggle with the pandemic and racism, a different threat is emerging: climate wars. Simply said, because we are not limiting greenhouse gas emissions, the world will get far too hot too fast. We will suffer in the heat. Millions will die because of it. The weather and agriculture will destabilize into extremes. That is the time for last-ditch efforts trying to cool down, to somehow go backward in climate time. The age of climate engineering is advancing, likely arriving in this decade or the next, and certainly within your lifetime. Humans will run experiments with Earth's atmosphere, land, and oceans. We are already doing that, of course, with fossil fuels, but now we will need anti-warming technology. And it seems unlikely that could come all peacefully by international agreement.
Radio EcoShock.
What if we can't stop a wave of superheat, storms, and cities drowning from polar ice melt? The ICU for global warming might be climate engineering. Somebody sends up a few planes to spray reflective pollution into the upper atmosphere like a sunshade. But who is that somebody? Could it be a major power or North Korea or just a billionaire like Elon Musk? What if it goes too far or leads to a kind of climate war? A new study from Italy says solar geoengineering may lead to excessive cooling and high strategic uncertainty. The lead author is Anna Lou Abadio, an economist and research fellow at the prestigious Bocconi University. From Milan, Anna Abadio, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me today.
To begin, what is climate engineering and is it the same as geoengineering?
Well, climate engineering is a large-scale anthropogenic manipulation of the Earth's climate. There are many different climate engineering technologies, but we can basically group these technologies into two categories depending on how exactly they engineer the climate. So on one hand, we have carbon capture and storage, which includes things like large-scale afforestation and directly capturing CO2 and storing them. And on the other hand, we have solar radiation management, or what in our paper we call solar geoengineering. So these include space mirrors, and stratospheric aerosol injections.
Are there international agreements or laws to prohibit interfering with planetary temperatures?
I know of one, ENMOD, which stands for Environment Modification Convention. It's an international treaty prohibiting the military or other hostile use of environmental modification techniques that have widespread, long-lasting, severe effects.
We had a guest on Radio EcoShock calling for an emergency program to launch sulfates into the atmosphere. He wanted to do it above the Arctic to save the last of the sea ice and to slow melting of Greenland. And right now, there's an experiment going on in Australia, or just recently in April, trying to save the coral reefs with solar radiation management. Is regional cooling possible?
By injecting sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, we've seen from volcanic eruptions that regional cooling is not possible. So in 1991, Mount Pinatubo injected 20 megatons of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, and its effects were felt 2 or a year after the eruption across the world.
Why do you, as an economist, investigate the possibilities of climate engineering, and why did a collection of Italian institutions join in this project?
Well, climate change, and hence climate engineering, are global social dilemmas. So it's not surprising that Italian institutions would want to study it. The Italian institutions that joined the project are Italian institutions that actually do very good work on climate change. So in fact, two of my co-authors are authors of assessment reports done by the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, or the IPCC. But also, economics is really defined as the study of how individuals allocate scarce resources. So should we allocate our scarce resources for climate engineering, for mitigation, or for adaption? So economists have been, for a while, interested in the instruments that can help the conservation of open access and common pool resources, such as climate. So Eleanor Ostrom, for example, worked on common pool resources and won the Nobel Prize in economics for it.
According to the Goddard Institute for Space Studies in the United States, our planet's average surface temperature in 2017 was 14.9 degrees C or 58.62 Fahrenheit. And that was about a degree and a half Fahrenheit, almost a degree Celsius, above the mean surface temperature for that period 1951 to 1980. If we could control the thermostat, say, with climate engineering, is there an international agreement on what the best temperature to aim for would be?
Much of the discussion in the climate literature is to keep temperature within 1 to 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial level. So average global annual temperatures around this time hovered around 13.7 degrees centigrade.
Can you give us a hypothetical example, Anna, of one country benefiting from intentional cooling, but another country loses out?
Sure. So if we pick a country near the equator, let's say India, with very hot temperatures, and a country very close to the north, like Canada, which is mostly cold, India would like to cool or geoengineer more than Canada. And if this happens, if India ends up geoengineering more than Canada, Canada would lose out.
Yes, we might have crop damage or just really unpleasant winters or something like that. How is it possible we could cool the planet too much? What is excessive?
Equatorial countries have summers of, let's say, an average of 50 degrees Celsius. If their goal is to geoengineer the planet such that temperatures in the summer would go down to, let's say, 30 degrees Celsius, just an example, what would happen to countries in the north? They'd have winter during the summer, and this is not going to be economically productive. So a lot of businesses who are reliant on the summer season would lose out. And this is what we call too much or excessive. So when we say excessive or too much, we're actually looking at the entire planet, not just individual countries. So if we sum up the benefits and the cost of geoengineering for the entire planet, is the planet going to be better off or worse off? If it's going to be worse off, then geoengineering might be too much or excessive.
Anna Abadayo, you are trained in economics. How could climate engineering affect economies, and would the impacts be international?
As climate affect economies, so will climate engineering. So I've said earlier that there are a lot of businesses and individuals that are reliant on climate for their profits and for their individual well-being. So if we tinker with the climate, we tinker with these things. We tinker with their profits. We tinker with their happiness. We tinker with their well-being. In fact, there's a paper that was published in Nature that shows that climate change affects all countries, developing and developed, but the effect is not really distributed equally across these different countries. So developing countries near the equator, they suffer more.
And what do you mean by high strategic uncertainty?
It's hard for a country to guess what other countries will do when it comes to the level of geoengineering that other countries will deploy. So given that final temperature depends on everyone's geoengineering, and counter geoengineering choices, the uncertainty about others' strategies make it hard to evaluate the proper level of geoengineering necessary to achieve the ideal level of temperature. So basically, how much a country invests for climate engineering is that country's strategy. But this strategy is highly dependent on other countries' strategy, which are uncertain or unknown.
Suppose one country launches a string of aircraft and deploys a shield of pollution. What could any country opposed to that do?
Any country opposed to that could counter-geoengineer, and they're different. Counter-geoengineering is basically the use of any technical means to negate the change of radiative forcing caused by solar radiation management deployment. So there are many different counter-geoengineering ways. You can countervail, which basically just releasing more greenhouse gas emissions, which is going to be bad for the environment. You can neutralize. We can remove or render inert the original SRM agent through the use of, let's say, electrical polarization or ultraviolet photoionization in the stratosphere. Or you can do the simplest, easiest, just physically destroy the deployment infrastructure. So military destruction of deployment infrastructure.
But unless someone keeps spraying aerosols into the sky, the solar shield will break down, revealing the real global warming from our greenhouse gas pollution. So why should we be concerned if this type of climate engineering is so temporary?
This type of climate engineering is really just a stopgap measure. And since it's just a stopgap measure, it's not really a cure. It gives the wrong impression, or it might give the wrong impression that things are okay when in fact they're not. So if everyone starts emitting more greenhouse gas emissions because they think that they can just geoengineer later or because they don't feel the effects of climate change and global warming, then that's not really helping our planet in the long run. So without proper mitigation measures, climate engineering it's a band-aid. It hides the problem. It's not a cure.
And what happens if the world is cooled by a successful sun shield, but then a war or an economic crash or pandemic just cuts off the program and nobody can get the planes back into the air?
That's really just like ripping the band-aid out on a wound that's festering. So if we have done our part to emit less greenhouse gas emissions, we'll see a slightly better climate than before climate engineering. But if we haven't, then we'll suffer the consequences of that. The planet would be too hot.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Milan. My guest is Dr. Anna Badaio. We're talking about climate engineering. And our discussion sounds almost like a kind of climate war. It's not a cold war. It would be a heat war, I suppose. Do you think major military countries from the Pentagon to China have investigated using climate as a weapon?
Definitely. The United States, in fact, has a very long history of trying to modify the weather for military purposes. So including inducing rain during the Vietnam War to swamp North Vietnamese supply lines and disrupt anti-war protests by Buddhist monks.
Do you know how rapidly a cooling change could take place? For example, could a temperature change be fast enough to interfere with growing essential crops?
Yeah, in fact, there was a paper published by Xiang and company in Nature, which looks at the effects of the Mount Pinatubo eruption, which basically injected sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. And they saw changes 2 months and a year after. They did see that the eruption reduced temperature by 0.5 degrees centigrade, but also lessened the productivity, agricultural productivity of countries around the world.
And I'm sorry, I missed that. How fast was that?
The effect was 2 months, and it lasted. The effect still stayed there a year after.
Okay. Now, aren't we already doing climate engineering as we drive gas vehicles to work and we light up cities with coal-fired power plants? What difference does it make if we try to cool things down as well?
But we're also already doing climate engineering, not stratospheric aerosol injection, but in terms of cooling the climate down. So afforestation, for example, planting more trees is considered climate engineering. So not all climate engineering is bad. For instance, Coca-Cola sucking CO2 from the atmosphere and storing it in its bottles, that's something that's happening that's not as bad as injecting sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. But stratospheric aerosol injections are dangerous, and we have not fully studied the consequences of doing so. There could be acid rain or changes in biodiversity patterns.
Is marine cloud brightening a form of climate engineering, and is it geoengineering?
Yes, it is. It actually falls within the solar radiation management category.
Well, I ask this because in April, during the pandemic, a team of Australian scientists from Southern Cross University in New South Wales experimented with marine cloud brightening. They want to cool the ocean to save endangered coral, which is a worthy goal. If that could be done, maybe that would embolden the Australian government to keep on going with their plans to increase coal mining and coal exports, because they can just fix it with climate engineering.
Sure, that would definitely be dangerous for the planet. So they're basically not helping the planet recover from excessive CO2 emissions. In fact, they're making it worse. So that's precisely the band-aid measure I was talking about earlier.
And people who fear unilateral use of climate engineering say once the tools are cheap, they're known, they're available, it will be very hard to prevent their use. So perhaps we need a moratorium on geoengineering research, or at least an international agreement to regulate it. Is there an agreement on climate engineering research in place?
As far as I know, there's none.
In 2017, your co-author Massimo Tavoni investigated the risks of free driving, as he called it, in climate engineering. Anna, what is free driving?
Free driving is basically the excessive geoengineering, or geoengineering at the expense of other people or other countries. It's a term that was coined by Martin Weitzman to show that geoengineering can lead to outcomes that are not good for society as a whole.
And scientists conclude the difficulty of controlling the use of climate engineering rises steeply as we get more countries who could do it. Why is that?
Well, I guess too many cooks spoil the broth. So basically, it's difficult to coordinate across too many countries or too many individuals. The more decision makers there are, the messier it becomes.
Well, I would add to that risk curve about the number of actors who could unilaterally do this. I would add the risk also rises according to the number of motives to do it. Some people might want to go down in history as the one who saved the climate, or they may want to make a profit somehow or harm an enemy. Did your study consider the range of motives to use climate engineering?
That's actually a very interesting point. Unfortunately, our study did not consider this, but this is something that's definitely worth looking into in the future.
And it doesn't have to be countries who try to cool the atmosphere. I mean, Elon Musk or Richard Branson, they launched their own private space programs. Why not climate engineering as well?
Sure, if an individual can afford it, why not? But this is precisely what makes climate engineering very dangerous, and this is precisely what's bringing about the coordination problems that we see in our study.
After gaming out a number of possibilities, please tell us some of the conclusions of your new study as published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Geoengineering is a potential additional strategy for combating the detrimental effects of climate change that is increasingly being considered in scientific and policy discourses. But while it may be inexpensive and very effective in immediately reducing temperature levels, it may also generate risks that outweigh those it is intended to reverse. So we see that there is an overprovision or overproduction of geoengineering. Free driving occurs. Also, when a counter-engineering is made available, there are huge welfare losses because individuals or countries are not able to coordinate with each other to hit their target level of global geoengineering.
Anna, in your personal opinion, outside the study, do you think global heating will be so severe and dangerous that climate engineering technology will be used, say, during this century?
Yes. Don't you feel it? It's getting warmer every year.
I do feel it, unfortunately. I believe the world just had the warmest May ever recorded. What would you see as the best and worst case scenarios if solar radiation management is used?
The best case scenario would be that everyone coordinates. We use it as a stopgap measure, and while we're at it, we also invest in mitigation and adaptation measures. Countries also achieve some sort of treaty where countries are compensated for losses due to excessive decreases in temperatures from geoengineering. Worst case is no coordination happens, no international treaty happens, everyone does their own thing, and the Earth continues to heat up.
And now the challenges and risks of climate engineering are becoming clearer. What should we do?
We should help lessen CO2 emissions so we won't need to climate engineer in the future. Keep the planet green, eat less beef, plant trees.
That sounds like a good recipe. From Milan, we've been speaking with Dr. Anna Abateo about the new paper, Solar Geoengineering May Lead to Excessive Cooling and High Strategic Uncertainty. You can follow up with links in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Anna, thank you for sharing your work with our listeners.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to do so.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
In 2008, at the Park Theatre in Vancouver, I recorded and broadcast a speech about climate wars by Canadian journalist Gwyn Dyer. But in 2008, Mr. Dyer worked out how the stresses of climate change would drive various national militaries into conventional wars. More recently, there have been a string of studies and papers about using climate control itself as a weapon. The prospect isn't pretty. For example, in February 2018, Marcus Lederer and Judith Kreuter published Organizing the Unthinkable in Times of Crisis: Will Climate Engineering Become the Weapon of Last Resort in the Anthropocene? Another possible variation of climate wars would be to stop a so-called rogue nation from continuing to burn fossil fuels after we have an international treaty. You know, in this scenario, a country like the United States, after suffering severe crop damage or storm damage concurrent with unbearable heat, they might bomb coal-burning power plants in a holdout country, like India, for example, to prevent their continued use and so reduce further warming. Recall that Israel bombed a nuclear power plant in Iraq to stop it operating for strategic reasons. Or a war might be declared by a country already transitioned to alternative energy like solar and hydro and wind against a fossil fuel producer who continued to ship out like the Middle Eastern oil and gas countries. But any billionaire can do climate engineering. The idea of a wealthy person blocking out the sun for their profit was first explored in the cartoon series The Simpsons.
Since the beginning of time, man has yearned to destroy the sun. I will do the next best thing. Block it out.
Good God!
Imagine it, Smithers. Electrical lights and heaters running all day long.
But, sir, every plant and tree will die. Owls will deafen us with incessant hooting. The town sundial will be useless.
Nefarious nuclear power plant owner Mr. Burns throws a shade over the sun to create more demand for his electricity. But since Mr. Burns, the stuff of cartoons and science fiction, has come well within the grasp of reality. Journalist David Levitan explored the idea of a billionaire deciding to unilaterally deploy climate engineering. He found Yanis Pastor, executive director of the Carnegie Climate Geoengineering Governance Initiative, found billionaire climate action is a plausible scenario. That article, published at Pacific Standard in May 2019, is titled The Billionaire's Guide to Hacking the Planet. A billionaire might initiate climate engineering in their belief that it must be done to save the planet. That's sort of a philanthropical motivation. Or they could do it because they can make money, say by manipulating certain stocks vulnerable to climate impacts. Or they could be answering a perceived public demand that someone must save humanity from extreme weather or other impacts. An individual or conspiracy might do it for irrational reasons, perhaps religious beliefs in the end times. Someone may seek to cement their name in history, do it out of hatred for mankind, or even to atone for a sense of sin against all nature and other species. When there are too many possible reasons for an action, that increases the probability of it happening. I've covered all this a bit before. Rutgers scientist Alan Robach suggested putting 10 million tons of sulfates a year into the atmosphere, right around the tropics, causes a significant drop in temperature, going from 0.8 degrees C above the 1951 to 1980 mean to about 0.3 degrees below that mean temperature, that is a drop of 1 degree C from only 10 million tons of sulfates put into the atmosphere. However, if geoengineering stops, say in 2030, the temperature rises again to about 0.1 degree C of where it would have been anyway, at the very least. You can find my 2015 interview with Alan Robach of Rutgers about geoengineering at ecoshock.org. I will put a link to that in my blog for this program. I have also interviewed Harvard's Dr. David Keith about using technology to cool the planet. He thinks it could be done, but only as a very last resort. Keith wrote the book, A Case for Climate Geoengineering, in 2013. It's published by MIT Press. On Radio EcoShock, David Keith and Canadian scientist Paul Beckwith have described the technology of solar radiation management. It can be just airplanes modified with spray nozzles and a preparation that includes reflective particles like sulfates. Sulfates are cheap and plentiful. We could even capture them from the stacks of coal-burning power plants. Dr. Keith thinks the relatively tiny amount of sulfur required to achieve the global dimming would be far less harmful than the low-level smog humans are breathing right now. It takes about 1/100th of the amount of sulfur to achieve the same effect. And don't forget, we already put about 50 million tons of sulfur a year into the lower atmosphere, mostly from coal burning, but also from other industrial processes. The amount being suggested for the upper atmosphere might be 10 million tons a year. We don't know yet. Scientists like American nuclear physicist Edward Teller proposed more permanent SRM techniques, like launching millions of tiny mirrors into space, blocking incoming light. That would be very hard, if not impossible, to undo once it's there. All another country could do to return to warmer conditions would be to put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We're doing that right now, and that is also hard to undo, as we are finding out. Here is my quick summary of 20 reasons why Dr. Alan Robach thinks climate engineering is too dangerous, just like thermonuclear war. Ready? 1. Climate engineering could result in regional climate change, including unpredicted swings in temperature and precipitation. Research suggests some countries would be devastated by drought or extreme rains. Maybe the monsoon wouldn't come anymore. 2. Ocean acidification would just continue, damaging the base of the food chain and wiping out species. Solar radiation management, let's call it SRM, does absolutely nothing to stop our continued emissions from changing ocean chemistry into an acid bath. 3. Several scientists suggest SRM would cause ozone depletion. That leads to millions more cases of cancer and blindness in some species. 4. A solar shield reduces the amount of sunlight reaching plants, reducing crop yields and all natural plant production. That's a pretty big change. 5. We would probably get more acid rain, which kills lakes and forests. 6. The world cloud pattern could be changed, especially high cirrus clouds, as aerosols we launch fall into the lower atmosphere. 7. We would all notice the sky becomes kind of white instead of blue. There would be nice sunsets. 8. With sunlight blocked in the upper atmosphere, there would be less for solar power. 9. Solar radiation has to be deployed every year. If it stops for any reason, we get rapid warming with huge unknown impacts. 10. If we do want to stop the solar shield, maybe due to unexpected results, how rapidly could we take it down and how? We don't know. 11. Just sending up a fleet of airplanes and producing the chemicals required also has environmental impacts, including increasing global warming. And then we have a large collection of unknowns with possible cataclysmic risks. For example, what if we miscalculate and cool things down right to ice age levels? 13. There could be unexpected consequences that we don't even know about, and I can't list them here, obviously. 14. Schemes perceived to work will lessen the incentive to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. Are you listening, Australia? 15. As discussed, there is the use of technology for military purposes. Are we developing climate weapons already? Are they disguised in what looks like research and testing with beneficial aims? Geoengineering research is like germ research. It can be used for good, or for evil, or It has unintended serious accidents. Maybe we just found that out with COVID-19. 16. Big business is going to get involved. How will we control commercial use of this technology? Could a corporation providing the solar shield keeping us alive gain strong control over governments? 17. By the way, climate engineering violates the United Nations Convention on the prohibition of military or any other hostile use of environmental modification. 18. Deploying a working solar shield and keeping it going for decades could turn out to be tremendously expensive, draining money away from other social needs. By then, we won't have any choice but to pay up. 19. Even if climate engineering works, whose hand will be on that thermostat? How would the world agree on the optimal climate? 20. Who has the moral right to choose and modify the climate? What happens to the people who don't want it? Should the animals and plants get a voice in what happens to their world? You can find out more about the grave risks of climate engineering from the etc. group, etcgroup.org. Climate engineering forces so many awful questions. How many people, in how many countries, already have the expertise to do it right now? Who will try it in 10 years, when the bad climate impacts begin to really bite? Could a country pushed by a population in panic mount a kind of Manhattan Project to develop and launch climate engineering? Has anyone already threatened to use this as a weapon, or maybe as a terrorist weapon? Could we be held to ransom by someone with the sulfur and the planes? Are large intelligence agencies already patrolling social media and other networks for signs countries or groups are actively pursuing climate engineering technology? Should I say hi to them right now? Will you go into a dark database if you download this program? As our guest Anna Abatayo and a whole chorus of other scientists have warned, our semi-intelligent species is not ready to control the planet's temperature. And yet we appear ready and able to wreck it with fossil fuels, forest destruction, and all that. This is a definition of a wicked problem. We're living in it, a crisis with changing data and no good solution in sight. Surely drastic action to block out the sun is not the way to go. The only solution to wickedness, we are told from ages past, is to confess our sins and choose right living. I believe there is still a narrow pathway where humans can live lightly and rightly on this planet. That is why we search for the truth. And then we have to act on that. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and let's meet again next week.